Welcome to Public Health Out Loud, Public Health for the Public. Hi, I'm Dr. Jim McDonald, Medical Director, Rhode Island Department of Health.
And I'm Dr. Philip Chan. Welcome, everyone.
Dr. Chan, we have a guest today. It's good to have Congressman David Cicilline with us from Rhode Island here today. Congressman Cicilline, thanks for joining us. Welcome. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
So it's fun to have you here today. And, you know, I have to say, I think you're the first congressman we've had on our podcast. So I don't know that that's an award or anything, like there's no prizes for that, but it's still just something you should know here. But, you know, I don't know that everybody in Rhode Island knows who you are. Can you just tell us a little bit briefly about who you are and who you represent in Rhode Island, please?
Sure. So I'm represent the first congressional district in Rhode Island, which is half of the state. I am serving my sixth term. So I've been in Congress 12 years. Before that, I served as mayor of the city of Providence for 8 years. And before that, I served in the General Assembly for 8 years and graduate of Brown University and Georgetown Law School.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Congressman, for joining us. We're absolutely thrilled that you're here. And we've talked a lot on this podcast, certainly about how the pandemic has affected things locally. And of course, it's been really hard on a lot of Rhode Islanders, had a lot of impacts across the state. But I think we wanted to chat with you a little bit today from the national perspective. And I think that that's something, there's been a lot in the news, obviously, but tell us just a little bit to start about how the pandemic has been for you addressing it from the national level.
Well, you know, I think we've tried as members of the federal delegation to be certain that the federal government is doing everything it can to end this public health crisis by crushing the virus, by funding vaccination so that we can get them widely distributed and testing, so testing and contact tracing can occur. And so in the beginning, I think we recognized that we needed to deal with the public health component of this. And we, I think, in an unprecedented way, made investments in vaccine development, in testing distributions, making sure that we were supporting hospitals and frontline workers. And then I think we had to, in addition to that, shift to kind of the economic implications of this public health crisis and pass the American Rescue Plan, which I think did both, devoted substantial resources to crushing the virus and then also dealing with the economic catastrophe that followed both at the local, state, and federal levels. And, you know, that work is ongoing. I mean, and we haven't turned the corner completely on this, but I think the role of federal government in providing resources to support the heroes like both of you and those that are on the front line of this pandemic has been really critical to make sure that first responders and hospital personnel and nurses and physicians and you know, folks who are really fighting this battle every day have the resources and tools they need to be successful.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman Cicilline. And I'm just thinking, like, at the Rhode Island Department of Health, like, we're often looking at the big picture, sometimes looking at the micro picture too, but like, stories matter. And a lot of times personal stories from Rhode Islanders, I think, are really impactful, especially when you think about how it's affected folks during the pandemic. You know, can you tell me maybe a story that comes to your mind about one of your constituents or, you know, someone in your district or just even yourself that just stands out about the pandemic so far that you've experienced? And there's stories every day, so I'm sure you've got one top of mind.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's two things. I mean, I'm very lucky. Both of my parents are alive, but they're in their 80s. And my mother has severe lung disease, COPD, from years and years of smoking. And so I think, you know, we were all terrified about COVID because she's one of the individuals who just wouldn't survive if she ever got this virus. And so, you know, doing all the things that everyone does to try to keep people they love safe and making sure people are, you know, keeping appropriate distances and wearing masks and now getting vaccinated. So that has been obviously really stressful. And I've been lucky because both my parents are healthy. But, you know, we have I call him Uncle Tom and Auntie Lynn because they're my parents' best friends. We grew up with them, calling them aunt and uncle, and they both got COVID very badly. And my Auntie Lane survived, but she, you know, has lost her taste and smell and lots of other neurological problems. And she loved to cook and she was a gourmet cook and she can't even taste food anymore. So it's been awful. And my Uncle Tom died from it. And, you know, for his children to not get to spend those last minutes of his life with him, you know, because of all the appropriate protocols, was so heartbreaking. And he was just such a great guy. And my auntie, at the time, you couldn't imagine them ever being apart. and, you know, COVID took him. And so, you know, I think everyone has a story like that with a family member or a close personal friend that's been lost to this horrible pandemic. And it just makes our responsibility to do everything we can to end it once and for all even more urgent.
And I think that's a good setup for, of course, a shameless plug for vaccination, which we know the vaccines are really effective, of course, for the Delta variant and all this, and they're incredibly effective. So just certainly if anyone's listening who has not been vaccinated yet, please go out and get vaccinated. But Congressman, I think that you touch on some things here that not just health related, but also understanding, of course, that the pandemic has really affected things like housing and schooling, social life, and especially people's jobs. And let's take a minute to talk about the economy. Obviously, the economy, business in general, has been a major challenge during the pandemic. It's one thing that I've learned certainly a lot here in Rhode Island is about the balance between public health and maintaining people's livelihood, their economy. Business, et cetera. But talk to us about what the federal government has done and how you've tried to support the economy during the course of the pandemic from the national level.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the first thing is, you're right, there's always a balancing of how do we keep people safe and at the same time ensure that they have some ability to make a living and survive and keep their businesses going and all the things that are necessary to function as a human being. But I think in many ways, COVID-19 revealed what has existed for a very long time in this country in terms of housing inequality, healthcare inequities, economic inequality. And I think it really laid bare some of the consequences of that. And I think once, you know, as we're getting through this pandemic and while we're trying to develop solutions to it, we have to be mindful of our responsibility to address some of these underlying inequalities in our country. You know, the example of housing where people are being told stay isolated or, you know, stay, you know, work from home, and, you know, people who don't have a home or have to live with family members because they can't afford their own housing and someone gets ill and all the problems that presents. So I think, you know, we focused a lot on what we can do to help businesses navigate through this. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of is the way that we really supported small businesses. In particular, we designed programs like the Paycheck Protection Program, which was designed to keep people on their payroll of their businesses, even though they weren't able to work, so that, you know, for a lot of small businesses, their employees are really part of their family almost. And so keeping people on the payroll was critical. And that was a very successful program. We had the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, which was grants to small businesses, again, to help them with rent or utilities or a payroll. Also, we created the Restaurant Relief Program, which was specifically for restaurants and bars, which were particularly hard hit, a significant grant program. We also, you know, something important to Rhode Island, we created something called the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program, which is for venues that have performances and concerts and live performances, which are some of the most hard hit because people are not likely to go to those places where there are big crowds quite yet. And so that was a lot of help. We helped, obviously, with enhanced unemployment benefits. We suspended student loan payments. We provided rental and mortgage assistance to help unemployed Rhode Islanders keep food on the table. And then, you know, we also provided a lot of support through a number of nonprofit organizations that are doing this work so that, you know, our goal was to make people whole so that even if they weren't able to work because of the pandemic, they wouldn't suffer serious economic harm, that they could take all these different programs and taken together, they would essentially make them whole.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, one of the things, I love the way you talk about helping people to be made whole with this, because quite frankly, it really is just an unprecedented disaster this country's never seen before. Where, I mean, the pandemic causes pain to every person every single day, whether it's a little bit of pain or the ultimate pain of losing a loved one. You know, it just causes pain every day. You know, it's interesting. One of the things I remember in the beginning of the pandemic was talking about how we had to do all these programs. We had to really shut down our economy because we didn't have a treatment and we didn't have a vaccine. And really what we're looking for is a treatment and a vaccine. And you know, thankfully we have both now. We have a treatment and a vaccine. And I'd like to shift our conversation to the vaccine rollout a little bit. So here in the United States, you know, we have three vaccines authorized by the Food and Drug Administration. You know, what are your thoughts on the COVID vaccine rollout across the country? You've seen it from a different point of view than I have. I'm just curious what your thoughts on it are.
Well, I mean, it's been, I think, challenging for, it's hard to understand. I mean, most of us got lots of vaccines when we were children. It was a kind of routine thing. And I don't ever remember anyone suggesting they were going to do their own independent medical, you know, analysis as to whether or not it was a good idea or a bad idea. You know, I saw a show the other day and someone said, since when did everyone in America become a doctor? You know, it's like, we don't have the expertise. And so we have agencies of the federal government, the best in the world, like the FDA, who do this analysis and evaluation for us, you know, staff of the best doctors and scientists in the world. And they say what's safe and what's not. And, you know, we are at a place now where we've lost over 700,000 fellow Americans to this pandemic. About 75% of Rhode Islanders who are eligible for the vaccine have gotten it, or have gotten at least one dose, which is great. But that means 25% of Rhode Islanders who are eligible have not, and that's problematic. If you look at the last 100,000 or so deaths that have occurred during a time when vaccines have been available, you know, it is mostly people who are unvaccinated who are really suffering the most. And so, you know, the vaccine rollout was done in really record time as a result of tremendous federal investment. So that's investment by the American people in the development of vaccine. It was done successfully. And then we spent a lot of money to make sure that we could produce the vaccine and distribute it widely. And, you know, that's been really, really important. But there remain, I think, people who are still unwilling to get a vaccine. It's hard to understand why. And if I, you know, I get into discussions with folks all the time, they say, well, it's my freedom. And I say, well, actually, I mean, you don't have the freedom to drive down the highway at 150 miles an hour, even if you want to, because it would endanger the lives of other people. And so this is not just about you. It's about your community. It's about your family. It's about your neighbors. And the vaccine is safe and it's effective. And if everyone would get it who's eligible, we would finally defeat this pandemic. I watched a show the other night about Iceland that since I think April of last year have had exactly zero COVID deaths. Why? Because virtually everybody's vaccinated. So this is not hard to figure out. And it's frustrating. But I think the federal government's role was to invest the resources to develop the vaccine, which we did. It was done at a very fast pace. Then devoted enormous public resources to, you know, producing the vaccine and distributing it so that it's readily available to everyone and free of charge. And, you know, we just have to keep the pressure on and encourage people to get this vaccine and to really just refute so much misinformation. There was a time during the pandemic that misinformation was spreading faster online than the virus was. I mean, it's just, it's incumbent upon all of us in positions of responsibility to continue to make sure people understand what the facts are, that this is safe, it's effective, it's saving lives, and we're putting others in danger by not being vaccinated.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman. And I think, you know, you're hitting on a topic that Dr. McDonald and I have talked a little bit about before, and that's this whole thing about myths and misinformation. I mean, it's related to COVID-19, but it's really much of a bigger problem than just than COVID-19. And, you know, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head about everyone's an expert lately, and, you know, no one knows who to trust, and there's, you know, people are listening to their Facebook feed and Instagram, and, you know, there's all these myths flying around. I mean, this is affecting many, many different areas, not just to public health, not just to COVID-19. And frankly, it's really frustrating to a lot of us, because if you can't rely on data and facts, right, what can you really rely on? And so I guess from your perspective, just any thoughts on how we can address this? What do we need to do both as a perhaps public health, but more as a country? How do we get a handle on all this misinformation and myths?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very serious problem. And as you just pointed out, it doesn't only relate to issues of public health. It relates to issues of the functioning of our democracy. I mean, January 6th was partly a result of a spread of, you know, tremendous misinformation and lies on the social media platforms. You know, some of this is the responsibility of the platforms to, you know, to make sure that they're not facilitating the spread of misinformation. Sadly, what we know, and this is something I know a little bit about, having just completed a 16-month investigation of the large digital platforms as chair of the antitrust subcommittee, sadly, these social media platforms, particularly Facebook, their business model, it really revolves around engagement. The more engagements there are, the higher the ad revenues are. And as it turns out, the most provocative, most untrue, kind of wildest claims are the most engaged posts and tweets and the like. And so there's no business incentive for these platforms to curate what's on their platform, because the crazier, the more untrue, the more dangerous the posts are, the more people engage with it and the more money they make. And there's a whistleblower testifying right now in the United States Senate from Facebook on this problem. So I think Congress has a responsibility. Some of it is to create, you know, privacy protections, to create some responsibility for platforms, for stuff that's shared on their platforms that's untrue. And then, you know, those of us in positions of leadership have to speak out and make clear what the truth is, that these vaccines, for example, are tested and are safe and are effective and they're saving lives. And, you know, unfortunately, we have members of Congress. We had a colleague who was suspended from Twitter because she tweeted a claim that vaccines were failing, which was completely untrue. This is a member of Congress. And I think comments like that make it less likely that people are going to get vaccinated. And, you know, it sadly is, you know, contributing significantly to people not making the right decision to not get vaccinated because they think it's unsafe, because they've consumed all of this false information. But I do also think that the responsibility also falls on us as citizens to develop a little better media literacy, so that just because you saw something online, that is, you know, means nothing other than it was online, and that you have some responsibility to, you know, go to reputable sources of information like the CDC, like the Department of Health, and get accurate information before you make decisions about, you know, vaccines or other important issues.
You know, Congressman Cicilline, I love that you use the word media literacy. You know, because it's one of the things that I think you're right, that when you talk about the organized disinformation and how social media platforms really are incentivized financially regarding engagement, because one of the things that's just been interesting on our end here at the Department of Health is just, you know, and I'm old, and I know I don't look old, but thank you. But it's interesting. Years ago, I answered questions, and that's different than getting in debates with people about organized disinformation. And it really gets this issue about not just people being unaware, but having real legitimate agendas to actually really just get in the way of progress here and really get in the way of public health. And I think it's just, it speaks to this culture of distrust that's formed in the country. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, on a national level, it's one of the things I'm most worried about is just the culture of distrust and really getting back to what the nation was built on, which is a culture of trust, which I think trust is one of the most important words in public health. And I, you know, it's funny, like when I think back to my own career, be doing this 31 years now, I've never experienced anything like this pandemic. And I'm just wondering, you've been, you know, congressman for six terms now, been in, you know, mayor of Providence, done a lot of stuff in this world, but have you experienced anything as challenging as COVID-19 in your career? I mean, I'm just curious if anything even comes close, quite honestly.
No, and I think, you know, it's a public health crisis, obviously, that, you know, is a kind of once in a generation occurrence, thankfully. But I think it's been made much more difficult by what you just described, this sort of developing distrust among communities, among, you know, lack of confidence in important institutions of a society, whether it's educational institutions, you know, public health organizations. But I think the other thing is, you know, there's been, you know, I think it sometimes it's hard. You know, I think everyone has family members that have, we've encountered someone who says, I'm not taking a vaccine, and because they read something which is completely untrue. And I think a lot of times our reaction is to be dismissive of it and say, are you stupid? Are you crazy? Like, and because that's sort of your first reaction. That's actually a bad way. If we're going to change people's minds and encourage them to think more carefully and look at the sources of the story that they're relying on, I think we have to learn, as hard as it can be, to be better listeners and to say, like, why do you, you know, what are you worried about? Why are you, I had a family member who wouldn't take a vaccine and, you know, gave me all the reasons. And I said, you know, tell me why you don't want to take it. And he explained to me, I'm like, where did you hear that? And, you know, and by the end of it, I think I finally convinced him that he was relying on some not trustworthy information. But if I had just dismissed it with, you know, you're crazy, and walked out of the room. So I think it's hard sometimes because we feel so certain about, you know, the science and the evidence with good reason because it's strong and compelling. But I think if we really want to convince people who are reluctant, you know, just engaging with them in a respectful way, trying to understand what their fears are, trying to allay those fears by sharing with them reliable, trustworthy information that responds to their concerns, it will bring more success than sort of dismissing and name calling. So I know it's hard. And I think if we use that in all other areas where we have disagreements, we'll be better off. I mean, I try to do that with my colleagues in the Congress where I disagree with on a lot of issues. I try to avoid characterizing them and just try to figure out ways to find common ground.
I think, too, at the end of the day, right, that, you know, there is some gray area. I mean, that's one thing I've appreciated the older I've gotten, is that everything's not black and white. And so there are usually two sides to many issues. And I think having that open, reasonable discussion and, you know, meeting in the middle at times certainly makes sense. And I, you know, I think to your point about being respectful of people and having that, making sure people feel heard is certainly important, and certainly as a physician as well. Congressman, let me ask you, I think, you know, here in the state of Rhode Island, of course, we've been focusing on some of these key concepts we've talked about, vaccination, certainly COVID testing. We've been one of the leaders in the country here in our state for COVID testing, and of course, support for schools and businesses, as we've talked about. Let me ask you this, moving forward, as we think about from the federal government level, talk to us about some of the ways that the federal government is working to end the pandemic, and any thoughts on how we'll get there, where we'll be, say, in a few months, and certainly during the winter.
Yeah, no, I think you've described very much the areas of focus. We have to obviously keep getting shots in arms, particularly now that boosters of Pfizer are available for eligible populations. And as we move closer to COVID-19 vaccinations for those under the age of 12. So I think, you know, the most important thing is to make sure that we're getting shots into arms to everyone who is eligible as quickly as we possibly can. The president outlined a very robust plan to build on the progress we've made to stop the spread of the Delta variant and to substantially increase vaccinations back in September. And I think, you know, the Congress is working very closely with the administration to really continue to focus on this whole of government approach and to really this very serious commitment, really an unwavering commitment to defeat this virus, not only here in the US, but around the world, because we have to make sure that we defeat this virus everywhere. I think, you know, it's important as part of this to continue to communicate the safety and the effectiveness and the importance of receiving a vaccine. We need to, I think, continue to be very vigilant in terms of our behaviors. You know, the deadlines that keep getting established will be decided by the spread of the virus, not by us. And so understanding that. And then we developed the American Rescue Plan, you know, as a way to make sure we were getting vaccines into people's arms and money into people's pockets to get through this time, getting kids back into school safely and get folks back to work. In addition to that, the plan allocated almost $2 billion in state and local recovery funds to the state of Rhode Island and to cities and towns here. And so that money was to help cities and the state respond to the pandemic in whatever way they think is most appropriate, whether it's you know, bonus pay for those on the front lines, whether it's help for small businesses, whether it's additional help for schools. So I think, you know, the federal government's going to continue to do both of those things, provide resources to defeat the pandemic and make sure we're helping to rebuild our state's economy. And, you know, we're on the precipice, on the eve of something very extraordinary with the president's Build Back Better agenda, which really, I think, recognizes that COVID-19 revealed some tremendous inequalities in our country. And we're not going to be able to build, we don't want to build back an economy to sort of what we used to have, the same old economy. The president wants to build back an economy that includes everybody, that works for everyone, that gives everyone a chance at success. And the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better agenda are going to do that. And so I see, once we get through this public health crisis and defeat this pandemic, we're going to have an economy that is growing rapidly. And we're going to have an economy that has a spot for everyone. And it's going to have paid family leave and universal pre-K and lower prescription drug prices and free community college and more job training and all the things that are, you know, affordable childcare, all the things that make it harder for folks to get back into the workforce are going to be addressed. And so I think it's going to be really transformative in a way, you know, in this gloomy moment of being in the middle of a public health crisis, I think it's good news to know that what's on the horizon is going to be great, great for the country, great for working people, and great for Rhode Island.
Yeah, and thank you, Congressman. As we're getting closer to the end of our time, just curious, like, the pandemic's affected me personally. I mean, I get to work a lot longer and spend less time with my family, but I feel like I get up every day with a job with a purpose, quite frankly. I got a reason to, you know, get out of bed and kind of just get to work and do what I can to protect the people of this state. You know, how's the pandemic affected you personally? I'm just curious. I mean, you've been living with this thing from the beginning too. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about this with my colleagues the other day. You know, I said, all, you know, so much of being in public office, at least for me, is about the time you get to spend with your constituents, being out in the community, being at events, not only because it's fun and you get to enjoy the company of great people, but it's also a constant reminder of what's important, what's not. People don't hesitate to tell you, do this, don't do that. So it's a really good way to inform the work you're doing. But it's also, for me, a source of tremendous pleasure. I mean, I love doing stuff out in the community. And so I was saying to some colleagues the other day, it's like all the fun stuff of our job is gone. Like the stuff that's left is like writing legislation, going to hearings, you know, doing research, like all the grind and all the fun stuff that kind of inspires you to do the work is sort of gone. It's starting to come back. But for me, I used to go to 8 or 10 events a night, you know, and now there's like one if you're lucky, and then people just aren't doing things and they're on Zoom. And so, you know, that's been a big change. I think, you know, there's a lot more isolation, even for people in public life. And, you know, that's our energy. That's what we feed on that keeps us going, is our contact with the people we serve. So for me, that's been a really hard adjustment.
Yeah. Thank you, Congressman. And thank you so much for joining us. Last question, as we end, any words of encouragement, final words of encouragement for Rhode Islanders who are struggling during this time?
Just, you know, reach out to my office. There's an enormous amount of help available from the federal government, from the state government. Sometimes folks don't know it's there. So if you have any, whether it's a housing issue, whether it's food insecurity, 729-5600 is my office number. There's a lot of help out there. We're going to get through this. But my final word is, please, if you're eligible, get vaccinated. It's the surest way to put an end to this pandemic, and better days are ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman Cicilline. And as we have a tradition of Public Health Out Loud, we usually give Dr. Chan the final word. Dr. Chan, what's the final word for today?
Great. Thank you, Dr. McDonald. And thank you, Congressman, again, for joining us. It's been a pleasure. In closing, I want to leave folks with a moment of zen to consider throughout the rest of your day. And here it is. Words from Alexander Hamilton. Those who stand for nothing fall for anything. Thank you all and be well.
I want to thank Stephanie Menders, our executive producer, Carol Stone, our technical director. I'm Dr. Jim McDonald. Have a good, keep up the great.